MICD Chat comes to you from the National Institute for Civil Discourse, a nonpartisan center for advocacy, research, and policy based at the University of Arizona. NICD Chat is a podcast series that includes episodes about NICD programs, research, and topics related to civil discourse and politics. This is NICD Chat.
The end of each year, the Nieman Lab has predictions for journalism for the next year. Michael Wagner at the University of Wisconsin-Madison talks about media, both at the national and local level. He says, quote, without a democracy-oriented national media and a healthy, diverse local media, all the alarms that experts sound about how our form of government is on the brink will go unheard by the people. As I think about that quote, I'm struck by the salience of the conversation that you'll listen to in a few moments with two authors of a recently published book exploring the role of local media in communities, particularly one in California, as a bit of a case study that can indicate how other communities might think about the role of local journalism in this moment that we find ourselves. As they say at the conclusion of their book, local newspapers are uniquely positioned to unite communities around shared local identities, cultivated and emphasized through a distinctive home style, and provide a civil and regulated forum for debating solutions to local problems. I have the great opportunity to speak with two authors of the book, Home Style Opinion, Joshua Darr, an assistant professor at Manship School of Mass Communication at Louisiana State University, and Matthew Hill, an associate professor in the Department of Political Science at Colorado State University. They have collaborated on a project with Joanna Dunaway, a book called, as I said, Home Style Opinion, How Local Newspapers Can Slow Polarization, published by Cambridge University Press, in a new series that's called Cambridge Elements. And this one is particularly politics and communication. In this episode, they help unpack some of the themes of the book, kind of reveal the realities that are facing local communities, especially when we think so much about media through the lens of national perspectives and what happens there. I became familiar with their work a few years ago when they published a 2018 article looking at the effects of the loss of local newspapers on local communities, moving people away from split ticket voting, for example, to falling into categories that we would now, in many ways, assume to be the case. One of the opportunities, as they highlight in their book, is a response to that concern raised by Wagner in that opening quote. If we are going to have diverse local media help us understand what's going on, not just in Washington, D.C., but in our local communities, in our state capitals, there's a really important role for local newspapers to be an essential component of our democratic life. Welcome to this latest episode of NICD Chat. Today we have two authors of a new book that's really, in my view, pretty fascinating, especially as we think about how we think about polarization and media at the local landscape and in the ways that we actually experience it. We have two of the three authors of a new book called Home Style Opinion, How Local Newspapers Can Slow Polarization, published earlier this year by Cambridge University Press. So I'm really excited to have Joshua Darr and Matthew Hitt with us this morning. Joshua Darr is an assistant professor in the Manship School of Mass Communication at LSU, Louisiana State University. And Matthew Hitt is an associate professor in the Department of Political Science at Colorado State University. So welcome to the two of you. Missing out on a third colleague, Joanna Dunaway at Texas A&M. But grateful to have the two of you here this morning. Thanks so much for being here. First, one, I mean, as I was saying to you a little bit before we started, I've known your names for a few years because I've referenced some other work that you've done in a similar kind of vein, looking at newspaper closure and the polarization that happens, particularly as it relates to voting behavior. And the reason I would show it so often was, and I'll let you say it instead of me kind of describing your work, but people would often ask this question, what does it matter when we start thinking about things like media, particularly newspapers at the local level? But from some of your research that shows up in Homestyle Opinion, as well as building on some of your earlier work in that 2018 article, The Newspaper Closures Polarized Voting Behavior, there are some real effects that come into play. So I'm really excited to kind of dig into these themes and for us to also think about, like, so what? What does this mean? So let's start there. Like, what is this Homestyle Opinion? You even referenced this, a little bit of this language comes from some other work from some others that you seemingly draw on. So can you give the real quick version, if somebody is only listening to a few minutes of this, or like, what in the world are these guys going to talk about? What is this?
Yeah, so this actually comes back. I remember when Josh was giving his research presentation at LSU, and I was there as an assistant professor a few years back, and Josh has done this amazing work on the decline of the local newspaper in the United States of America. And we got talking with our fabulous colleague, Dr. Dunaway, about what these newspaper closures were doing to the political landscape of the United States. And so in the 2018 article, we looked at communities that lost their local newspaper if it closed completely. And we compared the voting behavior of citizens in those affected communities to otherwise similar areas that had kept their paper or hadn't experienced the loss. And we saw more straight partisan voting in the 2012 elections in the communities that experienced the loss of their local news. So we got really concerned about this, as many folks do, hence the pithy title, Newspaper Closures, Polarized Voting Behavior. And so that led us to thinking, okay, you know, the local news landscape matters. It's this cross-cutting, geographically based source of information that keeps people out of some of the more nationalized, fractured, fragmented, partisan news sources that are out there at the national level. So then that leads to the Homestyle Opinion book. So Josh, if you want to take it here, because you were, I think you were the one who got the ping.
I was actually Joanna. Yeah.
Oh, it was Joanna. Okay.
So yeah, the story of the book starts with a Google alert. That's actually where we start the book in the first chapter. But a local newspaper out in Palm Springs, California, the Desert Sun, mentioned our article in an op-ed or an editorial column where they announced, the executive editor, Julie Mackinnon, announced that they were going to drop all national politics from their opinion page for a month. They had seen our article, and really what we describe in the article is a process of subtraction and replacement, where when you lose a local source, people replace it with what the readily available options for news. Those tend to be national, those tend to feature partisan conflict, which is a polarizing force for people psychologically. So she read our article and said, well, let's just drop that. Let's drop our syndicated wire columnists. Let's drop any columns or letters to the editor that mentioned President Trump at the time. It was 2019. But for us, you're trained in grad school to look for natural experiments. And this struck us immediately as being one. So we sprung into action. This was June 8th that we got the editorial, and the experiment was to start on July 1st. So we quickly designed a survey. We talked to them. They agreed to help us distribute it. We also used a survey vendor to sample from the areas where the newspaper circulated. We found a comparison community, Ventura, that was fairly similar and had a newspaper owned by Gannett, as the Desert Sun was. And so we sprung into action to measure really the opposite of what the article measured, which is the article asked, what happens when a community loses a local news source? And what we were measuring in this experiment was what happens when the news in a community becomes more local. Yeah. So it really was the vice versa flip side of it. It was a cool natural experiment. The LSU IRB was very quick, and we're very grateful for that. And so we were able to turn this around and really get the study going in just the span of about 2 weeks.
Well, as you referenced, I mean, literally on the first page of this, and I should note that this book is shorter than some, right? So there's something that it's a little bit more succinct, and in that respect, I think is great. And some people might want to kind of go and find this, but on that first page, that Google alert that you got, there's this line, right, referring to the executive editor there. She was motivated by this question, right? In an era where there seem to be countless forums for people to scream about national politics, are we devoting the right amount of space to local and state issues, right? I mean, just this, I mean, what a contrast in so many ways, right? When I think about the small town paper where I live right now, and I'm sure those who are listening could find their comparable papers, or maybe not, depending, right? As we've known for the last number of years, many of these are closing, they're really challenged, they're going to publication cycles that are different, they're no longer being carried door to door, but they're being mailed. I mean, there's all this whole landscape and has really changed in some significant ways. But the default in so many regards, and I know you write about some of this in the book, but like the inclination to always kind of skew towards that national perspective is easier. One, because there are just more people writing about such that you can pull it from, from kind of syndicated spots and things like that. So what was the kind of response? I mean, so right, you've just described the kind of academic side of this, of getting this kind of experiment going, figuring out a way to do some measurements and assessment, kind of comparisons of these. What was the reaction from that actual community where the Desert Sun is circulating, and all of a sudden, you said, right, July 1, this thing changes. What happened?
Yeah, so if you remember July of 2019, it feels like a million years ago now, right?
Yeah, take us back to that moment, because yeah. In some respects, like, this is really like a before time. So like set the scene a little bit here.
Yeah. So, so 700 years ago in 2019, before pandemics and all this other stuff, if you remember the Trump presidency, it seemed like a month didn't go by without some explosive and polarizing conflictual national controversy. And July 2019 was no different. There's a litany of things that happened in July, but a big one was that this was the month at which Robert Mueller was dropping his report on Congress. And so this was a major national news story. It was highly polarizing, certainly takes on whether that whole investigation, that whole report was incredibly damning for President Trump, or was just a partisan witch hunt. Totally was conditional on which national partisan news source you were reading, as folks might expect. So this was a time when the temperature was very high in American politics, right? Conflict was high. President Trump was very top of mind, leading political news coverage day in, day out. So what we know from social science research going back many years, identity is a strong driver of attitudes and predispositions. And one of the things that's been happening in American politics is our political partisan identities are increasingly sorted with the rest of our social identities. So it's harder to have that civic grace for the other side when it's not just my party, but it's my religion, the area I live, what kind of car I drive, what sort of diet I follow, what kind of media I consume. All of that is correlated now increasingly with partisan identity. And so that leads to this rise in what we academics call affective polarization, where it's a dislike, a negative feeling towards the other political party. And this is a powerful force in American politics. We have great survey data on this going back decades. The discipline. And we know it's gotten worse, generally speaking, over the decades. So as the Desert Sun, as Josh really nicely described, emphasized, relocalized their opinion coverage, we didn't see affective polarization, go away, right? This isn't magic. There's no silver bullets in social science. Yeah, I know, right? Maybe the next study, right?
All right, fair enough.
Yeah, but we did see in this month when the temperature was so high in American politics, President Trump was dominating the national headlines and commentary. In the Palm Springs area, among the readers who read the local news, who had high political knowledge, who were politically engaged, affective polarization stayed effectively the same. In our comparison, our matched comparison, sort of control, if you will, community of Ventura, California, affective polarization rose. It got worse among those exact same subsets of the population. So we see a meaningful effect when you prime, when you emphasize a local identity that's not obviously partisan, that's not obviously correlated with all these other things, that has a beneficial effect on the growth of this negative trend in America.
So to kind of succinctly say that, right, the benefit here is, in fact, that when you're looking at these two places that by and large would have been fairly similar, that this one kind of stays steady in some respects, while the other one, because of the environment that you were just describing, right, which is, again, kind of hard to remember the intensity at some of these moments of where we really were kind of this national kind of political landscape, the ways in which we were talking about things, how it was being reported and articulated, as well as from those who were in positions, President Trump, for example, at that time, still really, full capacity to use the various platforms and the like, right? I mean, so again, these are the scenarios that I think are worth remembering. So this is interesting because you just were talking about some significance here. If I can jump back again from the book to that 2018 article, one of the things that always struck me about that and why I love to use it was this question of like when papers leave, right? So this is, I think, Josh, you were saying a little bit right before we started, in some ways, the book is almost like a sequel, right? If to use your language. So there's a real natural kind of relationship between these in my view, and obviously that the article gets referenced in your book too. But what you found there was another kind of significant thing from a statistical perspective, right? That when these communities would lose these papers, that this kind of split ticket voting for presidential and senatorial elections actually changed, right? And so the split ticket voting decreased by 1.9%, so almost 2%. So if people follow politics, 2% is like, that's a pretty good percentage, right? In certain circumstances. Josh, I felt like you were going to start to say something there.
No, just it's a good recap of the article, and yes, if you study elections, and a 1.9% effect is maybe more exciting to you than it sounds. But that's,
oh yeah, because that almost sounds like nothing, right? When people are like, right. 1%, that's not a whole lot, but for elections, that really matters.
It does, yeah, especially with the number of close elections we have in this country at all levels. There's quite a bit of competitiveness all around the country. I guess the point there is that the book does serve as a sequel, but they're both sort of talking about the economics of news, really, in a way, and how political behavior responds to that, right? So it used to be the kind of thing where a local newspaper would have local news, but it would also have national news. It would all sort of literally arrive on your doorstep as a bundle of these different kinds of news. And as the distribution mechanisms changed, that just wasn't the case anymore. You didn't have to get everything as a bundle together. You could get your sports news, get your national news, get your local news, at least, for a while, in different places easily at your fingertips on the computer. You could select into those different things. And so local news, really, you would think that they would specialize, sort of maximize their market advantage by covering more and more local news and leaving the national news to the Washington Post and the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal and CNN and all that. That's never been more accessible and, quite frankly, never been doing better economically, right? The New York Times is thriving right now. It is not failing, as you may have heard. It is doing quite well because they've actually been able to move to a subscriber-based revenue model. Most newspapers get about 80% of their revenue from ads. And so to get the majority of that from subscribers is evidence of how well national news is doing. But at the same time that they should have been maximizing their advantage in the marketplace, local newspapers lost a lot of money. They lost a lot of their advertising revenue, their print ads. I've been comparing it to sort of Netflix and Blockbuster, where they didn't know what to do, right? The local newspapers are Blockbuster here, and they didn't quite figure out how to monetize their product in the online era, and people got the expectation that it would be free. And then they tried to put up paywalls, and people just gravitated to other sorts of free news. And so really, this is an economic story that has had largely political consequences in terms of where the axis of conflict is. Is it people you disagree with in your community about where a bike path should go? Or is it 500 miles away in Washington, D.C. about the soul of the country, right? Like, those are completely different discussions. And which one you hear, which one you see, depends on the news you're consuming. And as polarization has gone up for many reasons, we think that one of them is that people's news is entirely that second question. It's right, like it's the other group, they're far away. I can't quite picture who they are, but I know they're against me. And politics is about that. It's not about the things that we found replaced the national coverage in Palm Springs, local discussions about what might seem like mundane, but really are quite interesting topics.
Well, so we're going to take a break here in just a second, but when we come back, I'd love for you to kind of unpack like a little bit more of what that kind of mundane kind of stuff is, because in some respects, I mean, right, the way that you were just describing it, I think really captures a lot of this really well, right? This kind of large national narrative that turns us into it's kind of the gamification, right? As some people write and talk about this, right? It's the us, it's the them, it's the soul of the country, all these sorts of things. And to use your example, right, seemingly a lot of the local conversations are about bike paths and like figuring out how to levy, you know, the latest sales tax, or what is it going to do for the elementary school. So when we come back, what is quote local? All right, so we're back. And before the break, I was kind of asking this question, Josh, you were kind of framing this as these kind of two narratives, right? One is the one that overwhelmingly we're very familiar with, the national kind of political landscape, that conversation. And the local, as you were saying, is much more this kind of practical front that we're confronting, right? It's the bike paths, it's the questions about school funding or whatever else it might be, or whatever that dilemma is that's facing city commission or otherwise. What would be some of those examples? What showed up in some of your research and helped you kind of understand what filled that void when that paper, right, made its decision, we're gonna get rid of kind of this whole other piece, right, that has come to dominate, and we're gonna fill it up with the local stuff. But the challenge is, in my mind, is probably that took some work, because that actually filled pages, right, or websites and things like that, because people would still expect content even if you're not talking about what's going on in DC. So what's local?
Well, this is one of the interesting things about doing a case study, which the book is, right? It's a case study of a unique community. Palm Springs, California is very much a unique community. It's not like many other places. I was scheduled to finally go there in March 2020. So as you can imagine, that didn't happen. And I've now, you know, with my co-authors, we've written a book about a place none of us have been. So that's, you know, one of the things about local is there's it gets at the home style idea of, you know, there's sort of a something unique about each community, and whether it's the representative or the product of local news, they have to tailor their product to meet that community, sort of referencing the book Home Style by Richard Fenno from 1973.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about actually why you chose that name, referencing to some of that work, because that's specificity that comes from place, and right, that whole orientation seems to, even as you write about it, right, has changed in some respects, because those kind of boundaries, they're seemingly not as locked, right? It's much more porous. You can kind of, you don't have to rely on that paper showing up on your doorstep, so to speak, to know what's going on. You can find, I interrupted there, but like that home style language, I'd like to come back to that here in a little bit, if that's okay.
So that's where it comes from, is definitely that idea. And so I think what's generalizable about the case study is that the unique concerns of each community would shine through if other newspapers did this. not what the actual issues were, right? So in Palm Springs, quite a bit of what replaced the national coverage, the Trump coverage, and I will note, it was a fairly large hole. It was quite a void that was left. By removing national coverage. You know, less than half of the opinion page before the experiment was about California, even not just Palm Springs, but California issues. And so in Palm Springs, that meant architectural preservation. This is a big deal in Palm Springs, where they have a lot of mid-century modern architecture that they're very proud of. But that issue tied into bigger themes as well, right? Because the one place that was trying to be preserved was tied up in a dispute around the city because of a prior corruption scandal involving the previous mayor that he'd been removed from office, right? So even something that seems like they're just trying to preserve a building ties into all these local issues, and the more context you have, the more you understand it, right? The other big issue that replaced national coverage was the building of a minor league hockey arena. The Seattle Kraken, the new NHL hockey team, their AHL affiliate is in Palm Springs, or at least it will be. They actually haven't started play yet. But they were going to build an arena downtown. It was going to be next to the Agua Caliente Native American casino area. And so as a result, you had a lot of letters about traffic that this new arena would cause, which, you know, California, they're going to talk about traffic. But it also tied into like a really important local issue politically, which is the relationship between the town and the Native American land in the town. And so you could learn a lot about the politics of the community by seeing what issues came through. And those would be different in every community, but the notion of illustrating local politics with these issues that were not previously making their way into the paper at as high of a rate, I think would be generalizable to anywhere. And so if you're going to get that kind of local context, you have to have a place to read about it. And that means clearing out the national politics, at least in this case.
It seemed like, you know, one of the other pieces you were referencing a little bit of this, the kind of almost like the state becomes kind of that upper level. You know, there's a place in the book where you write about kind of the syndication you're talking about is less national and more state. And can you say a little bit about that? Because, I mean, in some respects, right, there's this whole, I mean, you could almost kind of create this kind of easy characterization of like, here's local, almost like hyper-local or municipal kind of regional level versus the kind of national. But you don't quite make that rigid distinction, right? The state plays this interesting, at least in my read of this, plays an interesting role in this, because there's still this larger kind of framing or kind of contextualization that happens, right? So this community is not kind of on an island, right? But it's embedded within these systems, right? Whether we're talking about those, you know, the building of these stadiums and things of that sort. But can you say a little bit about that? The kind of the Cal Matters, right? For example, some of this nonprofit service that helps maybe fill some of those spots where, you know, EGA Dionne and others weren't filling those pages?
Sure. So Cal Matters is a really important part of this study and a really important part of how they made this solution, because as you noted earlier, it is more work. It's more work to fill local pages with local content because you have to edit it. A lot of the story is about editors, right? And it's not just because an editor is the one who started it with Julie Mackinnon's editorial. Al Franco, the opinion editor at the time, had a lot of work to do with this. Like, a lot of it fell on him, and soliciting from the community, editing what they submitted. These things all take work. California is fortunate. They have this service called Cal Matters that's, you know, a nonprofit. It's funded by a lot of San Francisco, Silicon Valley type people, and it provides both news and opinion to the state. Any newspaper can sign up in the state and run that content. And so what we found was they relied on it quite a bit in July to fill that space. And so things that were EJ Dionne, Mark Thiessen talking about the Democratic primaries at the time, right? The month started and ended with a Democratic primary debate, more national politics. They were featuring state politics content, which quite frankly looked a lot like outside lobbying. It was a lot of powerful people CEOs. So of course they weren't writing it, their PR teams were, but the people who could afford PR teams were getting their content in front of people. And so, you know, people worked in San Francisco businesses talking about that proposition in California about whether workers were going to be classified as full-time employees who worked at Uber and that sort of thing. Academics will be familiar with Elsevier. They wrote that journal publisher who's been trying to jack up prices on universities wrote an op-ed that got published in the Palm Springs Desert Sun about how the University of California system should sign up for them and should pay them for their services, right? Even as other university systems around the country were getting rid of it. So we found this kind of trade-off where in order to make it easier for local politics to shine through, you had to feature some of these more powerful voices that CalMatters was delivering. And so not a pure like rising up of the local community to meet the challenge, but they were able to take the services that were available to them and patch it together to fill the content in July.
So maybe another way to think about this, or at least in my mind, this is not a story about let's abandon the kind of national story and go to the kind of citizen journalism or kind of the hyper-local framing of this. All of a sudden, we're going kind of in an unprofessional fashion, right? I mean, as you said, right, the editors, and it's always the editors, right, had a lot of work to do to actually pull some of this off. But there was a way for some of this to fill, right, so to speak, this the state level. I mean, you even talk about it. A section of your book, you're talking about it. A subtitle is "More California, Less Trump," right? And you have these great kind of graphics that kind of highlight what you've just been describing. So I'm coming to you today from the state of Kansas, right? And we have launched not super long ago the Kansas News Service, largely as a way to, I think, to do a little bit of what you were just describing, right? Not quite exactly the example in California, but kind of aggregating resources, recognizing that the multiple, local affiliates of NPR, for example, only have so much capacity. We're a big state with not lots of people, you know, all sorts of stuff like that, that it comes into play that, yeah, let's pull together. We have some common interests. So, other places are doing, I mean, interesting things kind of in the media landscape. Some colleagues of mine have just published a book called News for Us, all looking at citizen-centered journalism. So there's all sorts of interesting experiments that are going on in recent years to try to respond to this question of how do you, right, as was being described earlier, how do you go from a model when, you know, your local shoe repair store and whatever else, like we're running these ads and the landscape changed and the local media just has not done a very good job, right? It's the it's the environment we're in. So are other states able to do what California, or in this case study, what has been done? So instead of saying more California, less Trump, could we insert other places to this? I mean, and I realize that's beyond the scope of what you're talking about, but as you were kind of doing some of the research here, was there any kind of that consideration of like, what does this matter for people who are beyond this immediate kind of environment? That is honestly fairly unique. There's only so many Silicon Valley environments where you've got maybe some of this generosity that can help pull some of this off.
That's totally right. And as Josh was nicely pointing out, even this incredible resource of CalMatters gave voice to, you know, a more elite subset of the California population, right, which has its own concerns, right? The demographic diversity of the voices on the opinion page in the month of July 2019 actually got a bit worse than it was beforehand. So there were some really, I think, meaningful trade-offs, even in doing this with the resources of something like a CalMatters, which again helped the Desert Sun pull this off to begin with. I do think you nicely described, we are, it seems to me, to be an environment where as the traditional journalistic model is evaporating before our very eyes, either hollowing out or closing altogether in different places, the amount of experimentation is really quite remarkable, right? So as you described the Kansas News Service, you're seeing nonprofit news organizations now springing up in a digital-only format. In my state of Colorado, I'm very intrigued by the Colorado Sun, which a lot of the Rocky Mountain News was a 100-year daily newspaper out of Denver that suffered an ignominious death closure not long ago. Many of its former journalists are now at the Sun, which is a nonprofit, no paywall, some philanthropy, some voluntary subscriptions, things like that. So it, I think the answer to how would this work in Kansas, how would this work in Colorado, how would this work in Louisiana, is to a certain extent going to be somewhat idiosyncratic, as the states are different in terms of their geography, their population, their philanthropic communities, things like that. So there's not going to be a one-size-fits-all answer to how would this work in my town and my paper, unfortunately, at least in my view of the thing.
Yeah, I mean, even your example of talking about Colorado, I know there's some work that's going on, even at your home institution, partnering kind of the Northern Colorado Journalism, I'm not going to get the acronym correct, you might help my cause here, but using some of this language of this kind of deliberative journalism to say, how do we think about partnerships between institutions, local newspapers, for example, collaborating with higher ed and Colorado State. I know a colleague of yours and of mm-hmm. mine, Martine Carcassin, director of the Center for Public Deliberation, are really trying to say, how do we engage people differently? How do we think about these institutions as not just simply a place to get the story about the latest MLB rankings or what's going on that, if that's your concern, or kind of the national politics, because, as you said earlier, right, there are lots of places that are free, by the way, that I don't have to pay to get a lot of this information. And so interestingly enough, I mean, I thought about this, I get all sorts of Google alerts, and many people do for a bunch of reasons. And it's striking, I also read Google News, right, as one of my sources. And I mean, part of those systems are also the downfall, if I want to kind of be a little bit more pessimistic here in my language, of why I would turn to the Manhattan Mercury, for example, to find out what's going on. I can get it other places, or at least I have a few free reads before the thing shuts me down, right? So I can figure out how to do it. And if you're smart enough, you know how to do, your incognito browser. So listeners, if you're not aware of those things, you can go poke around. But like, there's all these scenarios that just, I mean, kind of stack on the real challenge. I mean, Josh, you said it earlier, right? This is an economic story with political kind of consequences, if I'm slightly paraphrasing here, but like, this is real, right? I mean, this is the real challenge in so many respects, but you were starting to say something there just a moment ago.
Oh no, just, I mean, those are all great points. I think, As Matt said, there are going to be a lot of region specific answers to this. And what I was going to say earlier was that actually colleges are a big part of this, as you noted. And it's full news services. We have a Manship News Service here at LSU that placed over 400 stories in Louisiana newspapers about what's going on at the state capitol. I just gave a talk at Boston University. They have a State House Bureau in Boston, and so. Students can really be a part of the solution here. But your point about Google News brings up the policy aspect of this, which is, I really do believe that, like, you can't just talk about media in terms of behavior. This is an institution story.
Can you say more about that? What does that mean, right?
I mean, so media in the United States has always been subsidized in one form or another by the government, whether that's carve-outs in laws or direct support at points in the 18th century, indirect support through the rise of communications offices to provide newspapers information, right? The story of American government and media is one of co-production. They both need each other. It's a symbiotic relationship. And as the media environment changes, those subsidies have changed throughout history. And so there's a lot of actual policies in front of Congress right now that would address some of these things, one of which is the Journalism Competition and Preservation Act that is specifically looking at things like Google News that you mentioned earlier, because if you get your news through Google News, they're getting the ad revenue, not your local paper, right? Google and Facebook are taking 60% of the ad revenue from what they're from the local news sites that they're using, and they're not producing the content. They're just hosting it. So the people who are producing the content are getting far less of the online ads revenue that is far less than the print ads were. And so it's a percentage of a percentage of a percentage. And local news doesn't like it. In Australia, earlier this year or sometime last year, I don't remember exactly, but the local news and Facebook got in a fight. And Facebook refused to host any Australian news sites for a while until people got sick of it. And and they honestly caved. And so what this bill in front of Congress would do would be to carve out a portion of antitrust law, allow local newspapers to band together and collectively bargain with Facebook and Google to get a bigger share of the ad revenues. It would allow them to reach you on Google News, so you get to see their product, but they could also survive because that's really the stakes here. And so we have an aversion in this country to government involvement in the news. We want an independent press because of the First Amendment and freedom of the press. And that's extremely important, but we can't lose sight of the actual history of this, the facts on the ground, which is that the government has always supported news. News has always helped the government do its job by distributing information about its policies. And government's role in ensuring freedom of the press might involve making sure that the press still exists. This is an argument that's made explicitly by Harvard Law professor Martha Minow in her new book, Saving the News, that I think is a nice complement to this, because we don't talk as much about First Amendment stuff. But there are very high stakes, and there's, at least at the moment, fairly bipartisan support for some of these laws that would continue to help local news continue that tradition of subsidy.
Yeah, I mean, even to that point, right, talking about kind of like the fourth estate and such, right, this whole mm-hmm. idea of media, the not just, you know, kind of the opinion pieces and the like, but just as this robust form of holding those in elected office and appointed office accountable and the like, right? I mean, this is part of what makes kind of the system work. And I think as you're alluding to, and many others kind of have long lamented, and it's, you know, I think, you know, the reference to what's kind of in front of Congress at this moment, some of these kinds of questions are real wrestling with what do we do here? Because we do have, another moment of time where things have changed, right? Because of kind of the aggregators, because of these major kind of platforms that have an outsized role. The challenges, and maybe this is one of those things, and we'll take a break here in a moment, but like one of the challenges for the consumer, for the citizen really, right? But in this scenario, really kind of acquiring something with some cost involved is that if I want to read the story from the Wichita Eagle, maybe it is easier for me to go through these other things to get it because I don't have to actually pay for it. And I think as was being highlighted, Josh, you were saying earlier, few, New York Times being one of them, but very few have actually figured out how to go the model of subscriptions to actually be able to make their work possible or even to thrive, right? Which is, I think, also indicative of the moment that we've been in for the last number of years as we think about kind of the importance and significance of newspapers, particularly doing investigative journalism and reporting and the like. But on the back end of this quick break, there's a section of the book that you all explore this question of, and you talk about it as the future of local news and opinion. There's even this, for me, it's a so what question, right? What do we do here? Because I don't have that capacity, right? I'm an individual. And so Josh, you were saying a little bit of this, this is not just, it's kind of an institutional story in some respects, right? I mean, so this case, and so I'd like to unpack a little bit of what do we do with this beyond just kind of looking at this scenario. And again, this is a case study that looks at kind of a snapshot in time, but that snapshot also ends, right? And so I'd like to unpack a little bit of that story of you know, so how does that kind of end? And what comes from that kind of on the backside there. So let's take a quick break and we'll come back with Josh Starr and Matthew Hitt in just a few moments. So this has been a great conversation. I've really appreciated the chance to speak with two of the authors today of a new book, Home Style Opinion. I've been fascinated by your work for truly the last few years, and it's actually great to have a chance to speak with you about it because you've always just been a reference in my endnote, speaking of those large aggregating systems. But here's this question that I was posing a moment ago. What is the future of local news and opinion in an environment that seems to just kind of keep skewing the other way. You highlight a case study of one community that experiments with this kind of trial, right? In July of 2019, they say, we're gonna do something else. We're gonna remove kind of the national stories. We're gonna use local. We're gonna draw on resources that exist within the state in California. So all of a sudden they're able to kind of fill in those voids. But what, in your view, and how do you write about this in the book, about the future of local news and opinion, right? Because as you say, page 66, if local newspapers are to survive, they need to collaborate with philanthropists and nonprofits, attract audiences with locally relevant information, and rally their community behind their product, and so on. So Matt, you were going to say something.
Yeah. No, I think this is a really important question. Sometimes, you know, we have some reader surveys in the book as well, where we, you know, ask readers of The Sun, what'd you think of this? Did you notice it? And some people are like, oh, I didn't care for this at all. Right? This, you know, I miss my Ibedion and all that, you know? So what I think is important for listeners to bear in mind here, and I'm in my other work, I'm very much an institutions guy. I study American political institutions. And the institution's angle on this, I think, is really important. And what I want listeners to take away here, in part at least, is that even if you are not personally a consumer of the local journalism that is produced in your community, you are nevertheless probably benefiting from it. Its institutional presence is holding your local government more to account. And there's academic research by some other great folks looking at things like government spending, government corruption, things like that. Like, local news has a beneficial impact in certain cases on those kinds of outcomes. So even if you don't read your local paper, you might miss it when it's gone. And I think that's an important thing to underscore here about why this matters so much. Now, in terms of what we talk about in the book, right, the financial model for local news, there's a lot of experimentation out there. Problem is, and I think Josh really eloquently put this earlier, the local newspaper used to be this nice bundle. Right, you got that important, beneficial local news, but there's also national political commentary, but then sports and comics and classifieds and all these things that you might enjoy the newspaper for. And now that has been disaggregated, where you can acquire a lot of that other entertaining content elsewhere. So the that model that made the local newspaper thrive for so long has been broken apart. And so that's why we in the book suggest that the future of this might not come from a purely for-profit enterprise, right? That there's not a drive among a lot of consumers of local news to actually pay the subscription costs that it takes to subsidize this. So it might have to come from government sources, philanthropic sources, community partnerships. Yeah, what my colleague Martine here at Colorado State is doing, he does fabulous work. Actually, one of their major projects was about building a new football stadium here at CSU. So the Ice Arena angle in Palm Springs resonates, that this was a huge issue in Fort Collins. This really divided the community, and the deliberative angle and the deliberative informative work that Martine is doing, these university partnerships are another opportunity. But I think we are in a time of disruption. We're in a time of major change, and I expect to see a lot of experimentation. And different models will work better and worse in different communities and different scenarios.
Yeah, I'll add on to that. I don't want to put all the blame on the consumers here. If you have a sense that your local newspaper is getting worse, it is probably. And a lot of that is because more than half of Americans who read a newspaper now read a newspaper that's owned by a hedge fund.
So can you say a little bit? A little bit more about that. Not too long, but like I'm thinking of the neighbors that I have that have lived in their same home for literally decades. I watch them walk out. Greg, he's a great guy, walks out and get his paper out of the driveway. He gets a few of them, so he seems like a well-informed sort of guy. But like, where that's coming from has changed over time. So can you say a little bit about that?
Yes. So as they've lost revenue, they've had to make cuts for sure. And the loss of print ads is a big part of that. But they've also been forced to sell to hedge funds that have no real interest in the local news product that's being delivered. They want to take advantage of the loyal subscriber base. lower costs and increase revenues. So they are asking their loyal customers to pay more for less news. And that's, you end up with this dynamic of ghost newspapers, which has been described really nicely by the University of North Carolina's Center for Local News Studies there. And, you know, if those newspapers aren't doing what they needed, you know, what they need to do, what people need from them, I'd still rather they be there. As Matt notes, their mere existence does a lot to discourage corruption, but both in government and in local business. There's just a landslide of awesome scholarship about how great local news is for fiscal concerns and all sorts of community issues. But if that hedge fund movement is going to continue, maybe it's not local newspapers in the old sense that are going to be the answer here. And this is why I think philanthropy is a big part of this, because there is honestly no better investment you can make if you care about saving people money, improving governance, than making sure that there's reporters at these meetings, than making sure that, you know, what's happening in the state capitol is being watched, making sure that what's happening in City Hall is being conveyed to the people in the community. You know, I'm thinking of James Hamilton's new book, Democracy's Detectives, where he just shows these huge benefits fiscally of investigative reporting. So it doesn't have to be the legacy media. And if you think they're getting worse, they kind of are. But just having some sort of communal source that people can refer to and connect with, it's the best thing we can do.
You, in the final pages, again, of a well-researched, well-documented, and yet accessible, kind of, dare I say, even kind of pithy, in a way, in contrast to a lot of academic kind of writing. I'm saying this as a positive for those who are maybe going to go kind of check this out. The last few pages, really, I mean, when you're talking about kind of the future here and talking about the kind of the hedge funds, for example, that come in and are purchasing up a lot of these papers that overwhelmingly for now, I think it's, I don't know, I hesitate to say actually the majority of papers, but it's moving in this direction that there's just so many local sources that are owned in such a way that it's really significant.
It's not the majority of papers, it's the majority of readers, right?
That's right, yes, okay.
Not all papers have the same circulation, but you know, something like the Denver Post, where their staff openly rebelled against their hedge fund owners because they were so disgusted with what they were doing with the product, that reaches a lot of people, right? So these hedge funds know they buy a big newspaper, they're gonna have more money to make out of it.
Yeah, and so in the kind of closing pages of this book, you talk about, right, the fact that this experiment was truly that, right? This local only opinion page, in fact, didn't get rid of some of the kind of the, as you reference it, right, the elite dominance on the opinion page. And they're really challenged, especially, and we didn't, you know, go into this too much, but you talk about kind of the racial and gender disparities, potentially as you start to have some impact, because this, you know, touches on some points that would have people respond. You write in the truly the kind of literally the last few paragraphs of this about where local opinion pages are particularly valuable, and in the moment that we continue to find ourselves in, related to, say, the COVID-19 pandemic, do you see this as an argument or some justification for its future? To say, you know, the moment that we're in now, this has done something, but also for the next time, because we will inherently be in another scenario dealing with some of these larger kind of collective issues that we do a real disservice, as we've seen, right, to kind of disassociate from one another at that level. So is this another one of those angles that, with a little bit more hindsight, right, this is, you know, this was published earlier this year, but that process takes a while, right? So how would you respond even to that argument that you've made as we're sitting here today, rather than however many months ago?
Yeah, no, that's, I really appreciate the question. So Josh, Joanna, and I did not set out to write a doorstop here, right? This is the book clocks in at under 100 pages. You can digest it in a sitting. I'd like to think it's, it's meant to be read not just by our fellow scholars, but we would love it if journalists and folks in the public read it. We tried to keep it so that the technical and the quantitative material is as accessible as possible and it's not overly laden with that sort of thing. And I think there is a broader point to be made here. For the moment we're in now with the COVID-19 pandemic, and we're seeing how divisive and political that has been, how polarizing that has been for us. And I think what's maybe a little bit of what the book implies, and what I'd love to see, you know, us continue to investigate in the future and other folks. So we think of some of these things in politics as these are problems to be solved, right? We have to, you know, we should come together and do something together, and everyone should agree, and there should be this consensus. But rather, I think instead a local opinion page can say, well, there's an issue in the community that isn't necessarily a problem to be solved. It's something of which opinions are going to differ, values are going to differ, interests are going to differ. And, you know, a unanimous, you know, wonderful coming together compromise may not be forthcoming, but for a more legitimate, just, and open society, voices need to be heard. And the opinion page where you actually have a true diversity of local voices weighing in on issues of local concern in whatever medium that folks are actually consuming that, I think is enormously beneficial for the civic health.
The very last chapter of this, as you just referenced, book that you could literally sit down once and kind of get through, and I can verify that is in fact possible. I'll say this, and then if you have any very last comments, that'd be great. But you write, local newspapers are uniquely positioned to unite communities around shared local identities, cultivated and emphasized through a distinctive home style, and provide a civil and regulated forum for debating solutions to local problems. When I think about this book, I think it highlights, I think, both the challenge, but also the possibility that exists for local news, and also its importance, as you said a moment ago, this is about civic life, right? This is not simply how do I get kind of the news story for the cheapest or whatever it might be, but there's something else that is happening here. I think Josh, you even said it, to paraphrase you slightly, right? Even if you're not the one paying for the paper to show up in your driveway or wherever else, you are benefiting from it because it holds, you know, governments accountable. It raises questions. It shines a light in some of these areas. So the very last question, and you know, I appreciate so much this conversation, and I'm sorry your co-author Joanna Dunaway isn't here today. But like, what would you say is the most kind of beneficial thing that you've learned from this project that you kind of carry as a scholar, but also as just a person who lives in a democratic society that in a lot of ways is challenged right now, and the role of media is one of those kind of big question marks. So what is maybe a hopeful piece for you as you think about the work that you've done here? Or if you would want to go that route, what's a challenge that's sticking with you that you want to kind of explore? And, you know, this is the sequel, so in part three of this, if there is in fact a trilogy.
Well, yeah, you need, I don't think we'll go full Avengers, but a trilogy
okay.
would be nice.
Well, okay, fair enough.
Although if people want to publish us. Yeah, I think that the potential of newspapers to connect people within a community, right? One of the things that stood out to me diving into the scholarship on opinion pages, which I honestly was not super familiar with, is this notion that it's the least professionalized part of the paper, right? Like that's where you go to read not journalists. And that's an important thing to do. And it's, you know, I'll reach back to Tocqueville for this in terms of just the basics of democracy in America, where he says, means must then be found to converse every day without seeing one another, and to take steps in common without having met. Thus, hardly any democratic association can do without newspapers. We have to be able to talk to each other, and to make that one happening in a source that people respect and have an emotional connection with is important. And two, to have editors arranging and refining and discussing with the authors to make those decisions, it just makes everything work more effectively, right? It gets around some of the the possibilities of misinformation, although you certainly do get misinformation in local newspapers from time to time, it allows us to connect in a moderated and respectful, just because of the editing, right, and meaningful way in a public forum that is at least accessible to most people. And if politics is about that within communities where, you know, the big disjuncture that we're not talking about here is that the news is bent so deeply towards national politics, but most of the governing is happening at the local level. And state and local politics is where the action is if you care about policies. But if you care about, you know, the sort of Sturm und Drang of it all and the clash of civilizations, you know, at the national level, that's where most of the news is happening, because they can find the broadest audience. So what can we do to make the news reflect the governing, and help the governing and make the governing work better, right? Co-production of the news, as I said earlier. It's to make local newspapers the source of these connections between people, to help us take steps in common without having met. We're invested in our communities. We have identities based in our communities. And if we lead with those, politics can be better.
That's a great point. Thanks. Matt, do you have anything to add on the...
I don't know how you can drop the mic any better than
I almost feel like we should yeah. just stop at that moment. That's
And so I think if we're going to do something else in this, to that point, looking more deeply at state local politics, maybe state legislatures is sort of a natural next step for this. I like the poetry of looking at places where new sources are beginning. So what are the effects of opening a new source of local news? And this is happening, as you noted, right? The Wichita Beacon is a great example of this, where the American Journalism Project partnered with a philanthropy group in Wichita. So a national group partnering with a local group to get the seed money going to start a local news source. That's the kind of model that we could study moving forward. And a lot of these philanthropy groups are interested in our work, and we've talked with some of them about it. And so I would love, you know, partnerships with anybody who's interested in expanding or relocalizing local news. We're ready to work.
Great. Well, thank you so much to the two of you for talking about the book and kind of the broader kind of trajectory of the work that you've been doing for the last number of years. Joshua Dar is an assistant professor at the Manship School of Mass Communication at Louisiana State University. And Matthew Hitt is an associate professor in the Department of Political Science at Colorado State, co-author Joanna Dunaway, not with us at Texas A&M, but it's been great to have the two of you. Their latest book, Home Style Opinion, How Local Newspapers Can Slow Polarization, is out by Cambridge University Press. As was noted, you can read it in one sitting, and I would encourage you to give yourself that test and see if you can pull it off. But more than just seeing if you can read something in one sitting is, I think, the real richness that comes from the scholarship. And I'm just so grateful that you were willing to kind of share a little bit more about that, because I think it really does highlight, as was being noted a moment ago, the real effects in our communities with not just that kind of immediate experience, but also something much larger than that. So thank you. I look forward to whatever comes next.
Thank you
so much.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
This has been NICD Chat, a podcast series from the National Institute for Civil Discourse, produced by Timothy Schaefer. If you'd like to listen to this podcast again or any of the other episodes, please look for National Institute for Civil Discourse wherever you get your podcasts. This has been NICD Chat.